Welcome to Israel Horizons podcast. I am your host, Maya Haber. Today, we spoke with Dr. Shlomo Svirsky. Shlomo is the academic director of the Adva Center and one of the most prominent Israeli sociologists. He is the person who first coined the term Mizrachim. Today, I asked Shlomo to discuss a completely different issue. Here in the U.S., discussions about Israel's occupation tend to be binary. If you support Israel, you support its government's policies, and therefore you support the occupation. Most people who criticize Israel's policies in the West Bank and Gaza argue that it disregards Palestinian human rights and deny them of the right of self-determination. As a result, the latter group is identified as pro-Palestinian, whereas the former group is identified as pro-Israeli. Shlomo Svirsky has a completely different project. He studies the cost of the occupation to Israeli society. The goal of the study is to convince Israelis to end the occupation not because they love their neighbors, but because it's within their own self-interest. The occupation isn't just bad for Palestinians, it's also bad for Israelis. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Shlomo, allow me to start with a strange question. You're a sociologist, not an economist. Why are you studying the economic cost of the occupation?
The fact is that very few Israeli economists have been dealing with this issue. They have been mostly silent, the issue of the occupation. And one possible reason may have been the assumption shared by many Israelis for many years that the occupation is temporary. Another reason may have been that to most economists, Israeli economists, the economic effects of the conflict on the Israeli economy have been negligible. Well, I disagree with that. Fortunately, I can say now that in the last 2 or 3 years, some of our major economists have started talking in terms of cost. When they talk in terms of course, they say this is, you know, if it weren't for the conflict, we would have our GDP would be 1% higher, 2% higher, that kind of thing. But they have started doing this, and I'm very happy about it. Now, I myself published a book back in 2005 in Hebrew on the cost of the occupation to the Israeli society. If you enter the Adva Center website, you will find the English translation of the entire book with figures updated to 2008. I haven't updated the figures since, but, you know, the basic idea is there, and actually if I go back to it, I wouldn't change much.
So what is the cost of the occupation to Israeli economy?
Let me start by saying that, you know, I'm going to talk about three main types of costs to the Israeli society. Types of costs, not specific costs. Okay, the first type would be economic instability. Israel is highly vulnerable to the effects of violent confrontations, such as the Second Intifada, which plummeted the Israeli economy into 2 consecutive years of negative GDP growth and 3 consecutive years of negative growth in GDP per capita. The long-term economic and social costs of that intifada included a severe cut in social expenditures to pay for increased military expenditures, and those cuts in social services were translated immediately in a rise in poverty from about a high in itself 17% in 2000, in the year 2000, to 20 to 21% in 2004, that is, after the end of the intifada. Now, I should mention that back in the 1980s, before the first intifada, that's 1987, the rate of poverty was somewhere between 10 and 12%. In other words, due to the intifada, among other things, they are not the only influencing factors, but they were one of the major ones. Anyway, the rate of poverty was doubled from 10 to 12 to 20 to 21. We are now at around, somewhere around 19%, and it doesn't seem to be going down significantly. Now, I'm talking not just about the major Palestinian uprisings, like the first and second intifada, but also about ongoing periodic violence, which is with us almost all the time. For instance, back in 2014, 2 years ago, in July, in other words, 2 summers ago, Israel bombed the Gaza Strip. We had a long confrontation with thousands of casualties on the Palestinian side and many casualties on the Israeli side as well. During that confrontation, for 1 full year afterward, tourism to Israel was in crisis. In such confrontations, as I said earlier, are highly frequent. Thus, the lack of a political accommodation is a continuous potential threat to the Israeli economy. Now, let me talk about a second type of cost. Talking now about the high defense expenditures, which is, of course, what everybody would look at. Israel's military budget is comparatively very high, at about 7 to 8% of GDP, while in most Western Europe, which is the countries we compare ourselves with most of the time on these issues, in most of Western Europe, it is between 1 and 2%. In other words, a huge difference. One result of that is that the expenditure on social services, as I mentioned earlier, is comparatively low. In 2013, for instance, Israel's expenditure on the social safety network was the lowest among OECD countries. OECD countries are those, you know, the club of the rich, the world's rich countries, okay? Our rate of expenditure on social safety network was 15.3% of GDP, while in the OECD average was 21.9%. That's a huge difference. Now, it is true that the large size of the Israeli military budget does not arise exclusively from the confrontation with the Palestinians, but we do have to keep in mind that on a day-to-day basis, the major actual use of the Israeli Defense Forces is the policing of the Palestinian territory. Now, to the direct military expenditures, we should add the high cost of the settlement. And I am referring to such expenditures as the subsidization of social services, tax benefits, the cost of special roads that circumvent Palestinian villages, and the cost of defense. For the IDF is used not only to police the Palestinian population, but also to provide daily, comprehensive, extensive defense to the settlement. Now, to the third type of cost, which is, how should I say it? It's a difficult concept, because I'm talking about missed opportunities. What would have happened if? Of course, you know, you cannot really know, and I don't pretend to know, but let me give you one example, and then I can expand a little bit on that. I will use the example of the development towns, such as Dimona, Yerucham, or Ofakim. Now, up to 1967, up to the 67 war, the foundation, expansion, and industrialization of the development towns had been one of the major projects of the Israeli government. I should mention that most of the inhabitants of those development towns at that time were North African Jews. It was a huge issue for the Israeli government, the absorption of immigration from Arab countries, of Mizrahim. Now, by 1967, the project was far from being finished. Nevertheless, it was overtaken by a new major project, that of the erection of settlements throughout the occupied Palestinian territory. The settlement project was started immediately after 1967, but it gained major momentum one decade later in 1977. Now, as I mentioned earlier, there is no way of knowing where the development towns would stand today had they continued to occupy central political stage. They might not have continued to occupy central political stage. But what we do know today is that while the inhabitants of most development towns still belong to the lower social economic ranks, most of the inhabitants of the settlements, especially those called ideological settlements, clearly belong to the ranks of the upper middle class, thanks, among other things, to heavy governmental support. Of course, the same thing could be said for the Arab villages within Israel. In other words, had it not been for the settlement, maybe some of the money would have gone to the Arab villages. Now, I must say that I'm skeptical about that because, unfortunately, it is only in the last generation, maybe starting with the Yitzhak Rabin government, that Israeli governments have become aware of the situation of the Arab population and the negative consequences of discrimination against them for the Israeli economy. Okay, so we have seen three types of cost to Israel from the continued conflict with the Palestinians. Now, people always ask, could you give us a number? What is the yearly cost of the conflict? What is the cost of the occupation? What is the cost of the settlement? I never give an answer. I never give a figure. Of course, we know the total military budget, but we do not know the cost of the military units assigned specifically to policing the Palestinians, because the military budget is not made fully public. We know the cost of negative GDP growth during violent confrontations, but we cannot fully separate the influence of the military factors from that of general economic processes. We know the size of governmental investment in construction of homes in the settlements, but we also have to take into account that those homes would have had to be built in any case only within the borders of Israel, within the Green Line. In short, we do not have a number, one number, but we do know that the cost is heavy. Very, very heavy. A political settlement, and especially one that would allow for economic growth and prosperity on both sides of the Green Line, would be greatly favorable to Israel.
Wait, Shlomo, you compare Israel to the OECD Club of Developed Nations to argue that the occupation and the conflict are costing Israel's economy dearly. But you yourself have devoted much time to arguing that Israel is not a startup nation. And our listeners can find your article with that name, Israel is not a startup nation, both on the Adva website and on Partners for Progressive Israel's blog. But in that article, you argued that the high-tech sector within Israel's society amounts only to about less than 10% of the workforce. Is Israel really part of the developed world?
I have been writing for many, many years, more than 30 years, about Israel being a sort of uneasy partnership between first world and third world. If you go to the Israeli north, you go to Arab villages. If you go to the Israel's south, the Bedouin villages, well, this is not first world, okay? I'm talking about the fact. Whether we should change our national definition, that's a difficult question. You know, I've been leading and participating in great efforts to change our school system. For instance, to make it more equal, to have Mizrahi children, instead of being sent for years, basically to vocational schools, to send them to regular high school so they can go to college and to universities. The same thing with Israeli Arabs. The same thing with the Bedouins in the Negev. The same thing with the Ethiopian immigrants, okay? So there is, I think that on the issue of self-definition, there is a growing agreement. And this is one place where economists are playing a role, but not only them. Journalists and columnists are talking about the necessity to raise the standards for the entire Israeli country, okay? So it's a fight. I must say that joining the OECD 2 or 3 years ago, you know, the OECD includes countries such as France or Sweden or Germany, rich countries with a long history of, you know, struggles for equality and for fairness, okay? But then we also have the OECD includes Mexico and Chile, in some of the Eastern European countries, with whom we can identify more. But the thing is that once we join the OECD, we have an international standard we can compare ourselves with, and we can now phrase our aspirations. In other words, phrase anew our aspirations. That was one good result of joining the OECD.
You've argued in the past that the cost of the occupation is closely related to the ethnic economic patterns in Israel, and that Mizrahim, and primarily Mizrahim in development towns, suffer the economic consequences of the occupation even more. What is the connection between the occupation and the ethnic problems of Israel? And why do Mizrahim, regardless of their economic status, continue voting for the right?
Okay, as I mentioned earlier, the settlements have taken over the prime stage from the development towns. Now that means a lot. That means, you know, not just a question of prestige or political prowess or political power, but also, you know, the standard of living, also the quality of housing, also the quality of education, the quality of teachers, and even more than that, the economic chances. If you compare now settlements with development towns, the development towns are spread far away from the center of the country, from Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. The settlements are very near the center of the country. Many settlers work for government agencies in Jerusalem or in Tel Aviv or in Petah Tikva. And as a result, they are not only better off economically and educationally, but also politically. The settlements are the major group with a veto power over government policy. The development ties never even came near to such a position. Okay, the other side of the coin is that many of the dwellers, not all of them, certainly not all of them, but many of the Mizrahim have been for many years now, have been voting for the Likud, presently for Netanyahu. Now, that has to do with history, with social history of Israel, because when the majority of Mizrahi Jews came to this country, the political party in power was Labor. It was Labor that, you know, was responsible for them being sent to outlying areas of the country, etc., etc. Given what happened after 1967, especially after 1977, when Israeli politics became bifurcated between left and right, essentially on the Palestinian issue, many Mizrahim, again, not all, maybe two-thirds of Mizrahim, felt reinforcing their position against, how should I say, a settlement with the Palestinians, because this is what the left, i.e. Labor and Meretz, wanted. This is not what the right, i.e. Likud and other parties, wanted. This is the major explanation for the fact that even though Mizrahim are, you know, those in the development lost out to the settlement, they are still wanting for the right. But we have to add to that even more elements. For instance, the military has provided many, many jobs for Mizrahim. If you look at even at the highest level of the military, the chief of staff presently, and many of the generals are Mizrahim. Many of the officers, all ranks, are Mizrahim. So that makes a connection between Mizrahim and the military very strong. If you look at Mizrahim women, who in the 1950s and 60s hardly went out to work. Now, the great majority of them work, and they work for the state. For instance, as teachers, as social workers, as medical personnel. So there is a basic identification with the government. In this case, I can say with whatever government, okay? But I would think that after what, 77, that after 4 years of Likud government, or right-wing governments with small interruptions for Yitzhak Rabin's cabinet, after that long period working for the government, you tend to take the government's position, which means being on the right of this political spectrum. So it's a complex issue. I just mentioned a few elements.
Finally, I want to ask you, what do you think American Jews can do to help end the occupation?
You don't change situation like that now between Israel and the Palestinians from the outside. I mean, it is true that the United States, not necessarily the Jewish community, can apply a lot of pressure, but situations like this are changed from within, from both Israelis and Palestinians. I think the American Jewish community, other Jewish communities, can play a very important supportive role, but we have to make the change from within. I don't want to discourage whatever it is that you are doing in the United States, because it is very, very important. For one thing, it is very important to know that to see on television and in some of the newspapers from time to time that J Street is finally being presented as a legitimate alternative voice to AIPAC. Because up to J Street, all we got is AIPAC, and everybody thought that, well, we can continue doing what we are doing because, well, the American Jewish community supports us. Well, it is starting to change. It's low, but it's starting to change. You know, I want to commend what you're doing in the United States.
You've been listening to a conversation with Shlomo Svirsky, brought to you by Partners for Progressive Israel. I am your host, Maya Haber. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Until next time, Shalom.